Thank you, Hank. I appreciate that. There's a lot in that presentation. To be candid with you, I didn't come prepared to respond precisely that presentation, so I'll do my best in the rest of my remarks to address them. I will say that, folks, there is no credible belief that the current health approach to healthcare is on actuarially sound ground. No one credibly believes that. And to portray any different, frankly, is setting up our nation for giant problems. We'll get back to that in a few minutes. I do agree with much of what Hank had to say. I mean, I do think we're in a very unique political time. His slide that pointed out that Mr. Trump's approval rating dropped below 50% in 8 days ignores the fact that this was an extraordinarily unique election cycle where, frankly, folks, both candidates for office entered Election Day with approval ratings in the 30s and disapproval ratings in the 50s, and so the nation was deciding between two folks that neither one of them had the traditional 50 or 60% approval rating that would make those numbers that were cited up there make any sense in any kind of historically correct context. What I wanted to come up here and start you all talking about was an update of the Messer family. You all know that we served together, we're still serving together. It has been a sort of extraordinary time of transition, as Hank alluded to in his comments. This is a time unlike any I've seen, at least in my soon-to-be 48 years. It's a time of sort of great ceremony. Some of you probably saw the inaugural address, and there is one of my favorite ceremonies I've come to enjoy as a member of Congress. How many here have ever seen the swearing-in or the election ceremony for the Speaker of the House? Have you seen that? Have you ever tuned on C-SPAN and seen it? If you've seen it, it's this sort of event where every member of Congress, has been the tradition for multiple hundred years in this nation, they all say out loud who their person is. I'm, of course, a Republican, so Paul Ryan was my vote. My friends across the aisle say Nancy Pelosi. Some sort of fire in a comment about the Clemson Tigers football championship, or particularly if you didn't win the election, you might throw in an important talking point that you're trying to make sure you get out. But I went, when I came around, you know, it's one of these moments where as a member, you know, as Hank alluded to, growing up in a single parent family in Greensburg, Indiana, you kind of pinch yourself and you wonder, man, how am I a part of this? This is really something. So when it came time for my vote, and I was alluding to the young lady here in eighth grade that I would tell her a little bit about what it's like to raise teenagers. Came my time to vote, and I stood up and went very traditional and said, Paul Ryan. Right at that moment, excuse me, I got a text from my kids that were there with me. And here's what it said. Great speech. Loved your emphasis on the word Ryan. Wonderful pronunciation you have there, Emma and Ava. Okay. So as I said to a few as I went around, how many here have raised teenagers or are raising teenagers? If you're not currently raising them, you're survivors of having raised teenagers. But it all keeps you very humble, and I think that's an important part of doing this job. You know, as we try to look at providing some context to what Hank laid out there in his slides, I want to start with a reference back. It's ironic he mentioned Hamilton. I have recently just finished binge-watching the John Adams docudrama on HBO. Did anybody ever see the John Adams docudrama on HBO? If you haven't, I think it's on Netflix. I saw it on HBO, but it's really fascinating. It's, I think, 9 episodes, probably 10 or 11 hours. And there's a scene in episode 2 where the Founding Fathers are at the Continental Congress. And to put this in perspective, I think we sometimes lose sight of the fact that these folks were all Englishmen, right? They spent their entire life for generations seeing themselves, although they lived in America, as members of England, or as Englishmen. So when they were looking to change, this was a radical departure from their prior life. And the moment in the second episode is the Continental Congress debate of the Declaration of Independence and whether or not they were going to file for independence or send a letter of declaration. And a gentleman, and I believe it's John Dickinson, because, you know, in this episode, they don't like put captions by everybody's name, but John Dickinson was a loyalist from Pennsylvania. And he gave an argument in this debate that went something like this. The time for independence will come, but that time is not now. We're not strong enough. If we declare, we'll be defeated, and all will surely be lost. And John Adams arose right after him and said essentially this: I appreciate the gentleman's eloquence. I agree with many of his sentiments. But where the gentleman sees apocalypse, I see hope. Now, of course, history is written by the victors, right? And at that moment, when our founding fathers were having that debate, there was no guarantee that we would have the outcome that we all, of course, today take for granted. But I couldn't help, when I saw that debate, kind of think about, man, something about all of that reminds me of where we are today. So what do I mean? Well, some of you have heard me talk before about the fact that if you look back at the last election cycle, there is no ignoring that Americans were not happy with the path we were on. The rise of Mr. Sanders in the Democratic primaries, whatever you think of Mr. Sanders was an announced socialist, someone who just espoused some socialist policies. He himself called himself a socialist, winning states in the Democratic primaries all across the country. Donald Trump, who among his other life accomplishments, was a reality TV star. That's how he got introduced to most Americans, who got swept into the presidency. I saw a clip today that was startling to me, and it just was a reminder of where our nation was just a year and a half ago. Some of you may know that Keith Ellison is one of the finalists for the Democratic Party chair. And they were showing a clip from the George Stephanopoulos Sunday show in the middle of 2015. A few of you are nodding because you may have seen it, where Mr. Ellison pointed out that he thought there was a chance that Donald Trump could be elected the next president of the United States. George Stephanopoulos guffawed. Everyone else at the table laughed so hard they couldn't speak. And Stephanopoulos said to Ellison, I know you truly don't believe that. And Ellison, to his credit, said, well, listen, I think you guys don't understand that there's something going on out there that you don't see, and crazier things have happened. Now, to me, there's, of course, a whole lot of things that the average person's worried about in modern America. But if there were one that I would point out, it's frozen paychecks, stagnant wages. The fact that in the middle of this economy, the median income in America has virtually flatlined for 40 years. Folks that are in that range, which is most of the places that we live, including towns like Muncie, our folks feel like they look down and see handouts. They look up and see bailouts. And somehow, they're all left paying for the mix. Told to just kind of, this is globalization and deal with it. And they look out at their leaders in Washington, and I've probably said this to some of you before, and it all sounds like the adults on Charlie Brown. Remember what the adults on Charlie Brown sound like? Wah, 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 wah. And they want something done about it. And I think we all have to understand it. And I know this, you know, like I'll go back and I'll tell you a comment about a recent Republican leader that really bothered me. And I think it led to him not getting elected president in 2012. But this idea when Mitt Romney espoused in some town hall meeting or in some small group that 48% of the people would never vote for him because they were takers. Well, let me tell you this. My mom is in that income group. She didn't pay more money in income taxes than when her tax credit worked out than she, but she didn't want a handout. She just wanted to live in a country where if her kids worked hard and stayed focused, they'd have a chance to succeed. It's what most Americans want. And they want their leaders to work hard and try to provide it to them. And I see a lot of what, you know, the consternation and protests and fights, and I'm not going to pretend for anybody that the rollout of the last 6 weeks have been the finest set of style points I've ever seen executed in my life. Most leaders learn that thinking out loud is the phrase I'm trying to get to, is not a perfect style of leadership, to be polite. So I'm not going to suggest that some things couldn't be polished up a little bit. But a whole lot of this, to me, feels like the status quo hanging on by its fingernails. Folks that just are used to an existing order, and when suddenly some of those things start to get challenged, they don't know what to do about it. So, what do I think that all means from a policy perspective of what you're going to see over the rollout of the next several months? And then I'm, as always, when I come to this illustrious group, glad to take your questions and give a little give and take. And as always, and I don't just take questions, I'll take statements too, right? Because we get a few of those occasionally. But it's this. I think you will see us do what we said we'd do. What does that mean? I think that, again, for whatever substantive bumps in the road, and there have been some over the course of the last several weeks on the president's executive orders on visas, as Hank talked about, to this week we have an enormous outrage in our country because we have a president of the United States that announced he will enforce existing immigration law. That's what he announced. That's what he campaigned on. It said what he'd do, and I think that's what you can expect him to do. I think you will see in all kinds of areas that relate to business an effort to restore common sense to the regulatory estate, which in my mind means things like what the president has promised. Any new regulations that come, we ought to figure out too, we need to get rid of. And in area after area, he will roll back many of the most onerous regulatory mistakes of the last several years. I think the two big agenda items you'll see on the landscape from House Republicans and then therefore make its way to the president's desk are efforts at repealing many of the provisions of Obamacare, as Hank alluded to, that have been unpopular with the American people, replacing that with more flexible options that reduce many of the mandates and give people health care that's both cheaper, less expensive, and also a better opportunity for families to get the health care that really meets their needs. And I think you'll see some effort at tax reform that, you know, the specific substance of that is still being worked out in detail, but I suspect you'll see a very big, bold tax plan pass by late summer. And then we won't just drop the mic after doing those things and go on we don't have a parliamentary system. We won't be able to call an election in September. We'll have to move on and do other big things too. But I think that's the big area where you'll see the biggest, broadest set of efforts in the coming 6 months. And with that, you know, I may have a thought or two that I want to end with, but I think I'll wait to end with it after questions, and I'll just sort of take questions from there and kind of leave you all with a parting thought. Thanks.
We'll bring the microphones over to you.
Luke, this is Mark Hardwick. First, I appreciate your service. Second, is I'm just interested in what does it feel like on a day-to-day basis since the election. How has the activity in Washington, from your perspective, changed?
So, great question. Everybody had a mic, so I don't have to repeat the question because everybody heard Mark. here's a little bit of a social experiment for somebody. If you haven't already done it today, Tomorrow morning, watch 20 minutes of CNN and then turn on 20 minutes of Fox. And then for that matter, go to MSNBC or ABC and you'll see three or four different worldviews in just one morning. And one of the most important things to me about being back here is it's great to be back kind of in a normal world where you get a sense of what people are thinking. Because I do get this very different sense that out here, most folks say, hey, we do a little work on a style point, sure. Don't have to agree with every single thing that's going on, but I'm more or less, I'm not surprised by what's happening. Out there, there is this sort of shock that you have an elected leader doing what he said that he would do. And it is sort of ironic, right, because there is, and I had the conversation with Kay earlier about this, but you know, you have this sort of odd world where every single thing Mr. Trump says, everyone's supposed to be up in arms about every syllable, phrase, or misspeak. And yet for most of America, I think part of the reaction of Bernie Sanders and Mr. Trump was that people got really used to not expecting very much of what politicians said to come true. Does that make sense? Right? So forgive the American people if they don't shudder every time a politician says something's going to happen and they wait a little bit and try to see what's actually happening before. The biggest advice and counsel I try to give everybody in this world, and I'm not sure, you know, by the way, whatever you think of balanced neutral media, it's probably a phenomenon of the last 40 or 50 years. Many of my colleagues, I mean, I'm a conservative Republican, I'm not sure I ever saw when this golden age of unbiased media was, but it's not something that's even been a figment of most of our nation's history. Go back to the Revolutionary War period, and it was basically whoever had a printing press had whatever point of view, and it's just more of this idea of what we have now, right? So, so I think people have a sense of that, but there is a tremendous energy that as Mitch Daniels used to often quote John Adams saying, big things are wanting to be done. That this can be a really unique moment. And I think that's what the American people are asking for. And frankly, many of those things ought not be partisan at all if our leaders will be willing to set them aside. Sure. Speak, Alan, of course. Well, look, I mean, I think I've worked very hard in my time in Congress to develop relationships across the aisle. I think, though, that frankly, the results of the election process have made it very toxic for my friends across the aisle to be, I mean, Mike, we just had a Fortune 2 CEO nominated for Secretary of State that got not one Democratic vote. It's not a very controversial person, right? And that's the climate. And I think what you have is that in that climate, you know, my optimism that that there's going to be a lot of reaching across the aisle is tempered. But I would also say, look, there are some of these issues that ought not be very partisan at all. You know, there's Mr. Trump's talked a lot about a big, bold infrastructure plan. Not sure why that should be partisan at all. If it's going to pass, it'll probably take bipartisan efforts. Many of these healthcare reforms. Listen, I've not talked to many of my colleagues across the aisle that think that the Affordable Care Act was perfect and that there weren't any mistakes made that could be corrected. But you know, will they be there when it comes time to try to work our way through them? I don't know. My most, and you know, Hank was kind to point out earlier, and those of you that know me know, I tend to try to shoot as straight with you as I can. I mean, what I observe is a leadership on the other side of the aisle that seems to have, that believes they learned a lesson of the last 8 years that Mr. Trump won because of blind opposition. I would just suggest to you that Mr. Trump won because many of the changes that were made by the leadership team under Mr. Obama weren't appreciated by large chunks of the American people. Despite Hank's rosy pictures up there, there were a lot of people that were disappointed in Obamacare and wanted to see a change. That's the truth. And the last three election cycles have shown that. I think the substance matters. You know, we didn't win the 210, you know, we didn't win the 12 election, but you didn't see the Republican majority sweep in based on protest. You saw them sweep in because of the response, the substantive reality underneath that protest. And if, for example, the reforms in healthcare provide better opportunities for health plans for working Americans, I suspect the protests won't mean much. But if we're unsuccessful in implementing those plans and we're unsuccessful in getting the economy going again because we don't get these tax package, you know, the tax reforms passed, then people, I think, will be disappointed, and rightfully so, right? So, you know, I remain ever hopeful, but also vigilantly clear-eyed in what I've observed over the last month.
Congressman, we have a question over here, please.
Yeah.
Regarding health care, we already have in place three excellent health payers in Medicaid, Medicare, and TRICARE. Why not just get Obamacare into one of those areas and just expand on it?
Well, that's an interesting policy idea. Of course, it wasn't what happened under the prior law. Got a colleague of mine, Phil Rowe, who is a physician from Tennessee, who's a great thinker on these issues, that I've heard him say publicly, listen, 90% of what happened under Obamacare could have been done in a one-paragraph law that said three things. We're going to prohibit people losing their health plan because of pre-existing conditions. We're going to make sure that kids that are transitioning into the workforce and 26 years of age are able to stay on their parents' plans until they're 26. We're going to expand Medicaid. And if you'd done those three things, you wouldn't have all this turmoil and tear up in the marketplace. What I believe, and I talked a little bit to Hank and his group about this when we were together upstairs, I think you're going to see a series of changes that include these essentials. We will keep the prohibitions in the law on pre-existing conditions so that folks are able to continue to get health care plans even if they're sick. We will keep the provisions in the law that say if you're transitioning into the workforce, you can be on your parents' plan until you're 26. Any changes will take place over a horizon of multiple years, not weeks or months, as some are sort of scaremongering. It took 18 months, by the way, to pass Obamacare and 6 years to implement. So to think that that can be undone in weeks and months just isn't true. And my guess is that there will be some kinds of grandfathering provisions for folks who are currently on Medicaid. And so plans like what's happened in Indiana will be able to continue. I think from an Indiana perspective, by the way, the architect of the Healthy Indiana Plan, at a practical policy level, Seema Verma, who's a remarkable person if you've ever had a chance to meet her, is now been hired by the Trump administration to implement these changes. So I think it's a very real expectation that Indiana's plan will become kind of a model of what could be done across the country. Indiana's plan, by the way, does not resemble most Obamacare plans across the country, and that it has a far more robust use of medical savings accounts, for example, and is much more focused on making the folks that are on this plan genuine consumers who get to make decisions and make their life better in the process. So that's my hope. I think that's what you'll see coming out in the coming weeks. Yes?
Congressman, one final question on the other side of the room here.
Jeff Arnold, Congressman, thank you for spending time with us today. Any president's legacy can be the Supreme Court nomination.
Yeah.
Whatever happens in this next 4 years or doesn't happen, that can have an impact on our lives for the next 30 years. Apparently, there appears to be a fight on the horizon. A conservative group is running ads locally, I'm sure nationally, but that's got to be costing millions. Give me your thoughts on that and what you think this confirmation is going to be like.
Well, first let me say, thank you for the question. First let me say Judge Gorsuch is a remarkable justice. He has a distinguished record. He is clearly qualified for the job, and he should be unquestionably confirmed. There is no credible question whether most Hoosiers would agree with that. There is... In poll after poll, it's been shown that for many voters, the selection of the next Supreme Court justice was top of mind in who they selected to be president of the United States. Throughout the campaign, Donald Trump made clear he would support a conservative justice. By the way, throughout the campaign, Mrs. Clinton made clear she would not. And Mr. Trump won the election. And I think the American, and it now put forward a justice that the vast majority of Americans that voted for him, and the vast majority of them that didn't, by the way, would have expected him to nominate. Right? I believe Justice, I shouldn't already call him Justice Gorsuch, he's not quite there yet, but I am optimistic and I believe he will be confirmed because he should be confirmed. There is some question of whether that will happen in the traditional way where we have cloture and 60 senators agree to have his nomination come to the fore and then he's voted upon. I know there are some ads out there. I, of course, have nothing to do with them and know nothing about them. You know, I know we got a representative of Mr. Donnelly's here, and you could ask him privately kind of the path they're on. My sense is, from everything that Mr. Donnelly has said before, that he will vote for cloture. I mean, he has said that he believes that these justices should be considered on their merits. And if you ask me to guess, I believe he'll vote for Judge Gorsuch too, because he understands that he is Indiana's senator, and that's what the vast majority of Hoosiers want him to do. So let me start backwards from there, Mayor. First, I know of no one in Congress who believes we should not do everything possible to protect, preserve, and take care of Social Security and Medicare. That is a bipartisan consensus. There may be some disagreement on the specific policies of how you do that, but that is an American institution. We have to protect and preserve those programs, and I think you have give you every assurance that those efforts will continue. I think you allude to something that's also true in that subject matter area, and it applies to our broader debate on healthcare, applies on all these programs, that our national debt is a national security and quality of life problem. We can't continue on the same path of spending money we don't have. And we've got to figure out how we make the hard choices it takes to make sure these programs all continue. Because you can look at nations around the globe that didn't, and many of them are fraught with turmoil. Second point. Completely agree with you on the fact that we live in the real world on these immigration issues. I think one of the challenges we've had, and I think why you see everyday hardworking Americans upset with the status quo, is people are tired of lawlessness, right? Which has essentially been the policy of not just, by the way, the last 8 years, but the way many of these issues were handled over a very long time as a nation. It's been 30 plus years since we've had a major effort at examining what we're doing in the world of immigration. And I think it's long past time that we have an adult conversation as a nation about how we tackle these issues. I think it starts with two very simple principles. And from those principles, I think you have the ability to then do much more to meet your concerns. We've got to secure our borders. Can't be a sovereign nation without a secure border. And we need to enforce our law. And I believe once most Americans see those two things happening, we can have a much broader debate. And that neither of those things ought to take that long. I mean, you know, we can have a much broader debate about what do we do in the real world where we live. I mean, I'll just give you one example. I mean, our nation's approach to dealing with high-skilled visas makes absolutely no sense. We train people here in America on the best techniques in the world, and then many of them have to leave. Why would we do that if we have jobs that are here that aren't being filled? 80% of our immigration system is a lottery with no focus on skill, which, by the way, is the complete reverse of what most nations in the world do. Most nations have 80%+ of their immigration system based on skill and whether you have jobs in the workforce. So that's an example of some of the things that we need to rethink. He's standing up, so I'm probably running out of time. Let me leave y'all. Gentleman had a question, or what? How much time do we? Is it 1 o'clock?
I mean, it's your time.
Okay. I'll take one more. No worries. Can I ask you a sincere question? I very much appreciate your concerns and sound like I agree with almost all of them. And I mean this as a sincere question. Do you feel welcome in this community? Yeah. And do you feel like your patients are happy that you're here to serve them? Yeah. And my point is this, is I think a whole lot of the sentiment you expressed is stirred up by people that have nothing to do with our community. And I think the community that I live in are good and decent people that are really glad and happy you're here and appreciative of you being here. And I think many of them, as I said to you earlier, Donald Trump is not a lawyer. He's not as precise in every utterance that he's made as some other leaders have been before. But I think the vast majority of people that voted for Mr. Trump took him very seriously, and not every word he said literally. So, and I think folks that want to stir up political angst want to take every single word he says literally and try to stir up concern and consternation in ways that I think don't reflect either the specifics of his policies or the likely policy direction. For example, I just cannot imagine a world where high-skilled visas go backwards in the coming months and years. Won't happen. And as somebody who's been elected to be a leader in this area, I just want to also say to you, I believe those communities from the bottom of their heart appreciate you and the people you're working for. I do. I believe it. And I believe, I mean, you all can look at the election results. Mr. Trump did pretty well in those communities. But I think those people appreciate you and believe in you and appreciate all the work that you do. I think it's important we say those things out loud. Here, last thought, okay? It's a version of some of the things that I've said to you before, but just two thoughts. First, and I'm violating, Van would have had me sit down 15 minutes ago. I should have. He's right. He's told me this forever, and I just can't help myself. First, let's just all as friends and neighbors agree to hit the pause button every time we see something on Facebook or turn on the TV and somebody's attributing the absolute worst motivations and specifics to a policy that came forward. Thank you. Right. Now let's get to the facts. There's plenty of legitimate debates and there's plenty of room for disagreement, but let's just make sure they're based on facts and not some kind of conjecture of what somebody's made up about what may or may not be true. Second, never stop believing in the United States of America. Okay? Never stop believing. All right? So the nation has been through a Revolutionary War, Civil War, Great Depressions, two World Wars. We're going to make it through this time, too. We're going to make it through this time, too. Thank you all very much. Appreciate the chance to be here.